From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Labor Day. It's here and now. 800,000 young immigrants await President Trump's announcement about the future of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. Trump is expected to say tomorrow that he will end DACA following a six-month delay that would give Congress an opportunity to find a legislative solution. That's according to Politico and other news outlets. The decision has not been confirmed by the White House. The Obama-era program allows immigrants who were brought to this country legally as children to receive temporary work permits without fear of deportation. And DACA is lining up to be one of the many issues that Congress will have to deal with when it returns from recess tomorrow. Jeff Bennett joins us now. He's NPR's White House reporter. Hi there, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing all right. So first of all, let's just talk a little bit more about DACA, because the president had said back in April that so-called dreamers should, quote, rest easy, and that his administration was not after the dreamers. We're after the criminals, he said. So what might have changed?
Well, what changed, Meghna, is that there's a group of Republican state officials from 10 states who threatened legal action. They threatened to sue over the DACA policy if the Trump administration didn't decide to end it on their own. And they gave the White House this deadline of September 5th. So we should say we don't yet know what President Trump will decide to do. I think all of the reporting out today and out last night all includes the caveat that the Trump administration could change its mind. But from what we understand from Politico is that, as you said, the president has decided to terminate this DACA program, but to give a six-month window for Congress to act, essentially kicking this issue over to Capitol Hill. Now, we should say the reason that DACA exists in the first place is because Congress failed to enact a legislative solution to protect young undocumented immigrants, and former President Obama established it through executive order. So really the only thing changing the calculus here for Congress is this now six-month deadline. And that will surely, you know, focus the minds of lawmakers. But we don't know for sure if they can act within that time frame, or more to the point, what would happen if they don't.
OK, so let's talk a little bit more about that, though, Jeff, because as we mentioned a little earlier, nearly 800,000 young people are in this program. And there are members of the Republican Party itself who say they don't want to see it simply end. It is sort of politically popular in a lot of places. So, I mean, what would it take? What kind of pressure are certain congressional members feeling even within the GOP to come to some sort of legislative solution?
And the program as it stands is popular with the American public writ large. I mean, the thing that we heard from House Speaker Paul Ryan last week was that he didn't think that President Obama had the authority to write this policy, to, in effect, you know, write law on his own. And so what he said was that in much the same way that President Obama shouldn't have done it, President Trump shouldn't take steps on his own to end the policy. It's up to Congress to enact a fix. Now, House Speaker Paul Ryan wouldn't even allow a vote on a broader immigration reform bill that passed the Senate in 2013. So, you know, as you mentioned, the politics here are pretty fraught. But there's a moral issue here. There's a big political issue. Republicans don't really want to be on the hook for the backlash, for the fallout that could come for, you know, deporting these roughly a million young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country, as they say, through no fault of their own. Mm. So that is the thing that I think will be the change here.
Well, it's shaping up to be an incredibly busy September for Congress. I mean, let's also talk about North Korea here, because, of course, the Trump administration and Washington as a whole is dealing with North Korea's latest nuclear test over the weekend. And yesterday, the president tweeted, quote, "The United States is considering, in addition to other options, stopping all trade with any country doing business with North Korea." I mean, that would include China. So how likely is that to happen?
It would include China. I mean, and the other thing is, I think, you know, he saved some of his sharpest criticism for South Korea, accusing them of appeasement. And he wants China. He wants South Korea. He wants other actors in the region to do more, to apply more economic pressure. We also heard from Nikki Haley at an emergency UN Security Council meeting today. She said that Kim Jong-un was begging for war. Defense Secretary James Mattis was at the White House speaking from the West Wing about this, which is unusual, and he warned of a massive military response. So, you know, North Korea claiming to have tested this hydrogen bomb really prompted a ratcheting up of responses from the Trump administration, which we've seen before. What's different now is that this is their sixth nuclear test and by far the most provocative.
Well, in the last minute that we have, Jeff, let's just talk about Hurricane Harvey relief. We've got some tape here. This is Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, a Republican. He spoke to NBC's Meet the Press yesterday about the issues that Congress has to tackle. And here's what he said.
I think it does create another reason as to why you want to keep the government open. It's frankly, no interest in Republican leaders. I would think any leaders on Capitol Hill of not keeping the government open. But the president's attention to this issue, I think, puts another reason on the table to get things done in September.
He's talking there about the pending debt ceiling fight and how the Harvey relief could get all caught up in that. What else are lawmakers saying about what they have to do when they come back?
Yeah, and the White House has signaled that they won't try to shut down the government in October if they don't get the wall money, the U.S.-Mexico border wall money they've asked for. Because you can imagine how shutting down the government would really be disastrous on multiple levels given the Harvey initiative. But they've got to raise the debt ceiling. They've got to pass a bill to keep the government funded. They've got to actually reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program. They've got to reauthorize the FAA. So there are a number of things, all of which have, you know, critical can't-miss deadlines that that they face when they come back this week.
Jeff Bennett, NPR White House reporter. Thank you so much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Let's turn to Houston now, where the mayor there says the city has started to get back on its feet. Sylvester Turner told CBS yesterday that only a couple parts of the city are still underwater, and he expects life to start getting back to normal after the Labor Day holiday.
The city of Houston is open for business. And so if you have a conference, a convention, a concert, any of those things that were planned, that you were planning to come to this city, we are still ready to welcome you. On Tuesday, we are getting back on our feet, and I'm expecting employers to open, employees to go to work, and all city employees, you are due back at work on Tuesday.
But Hurricane Harvey damaged up to 200,000 homes, and many of those homeowners now face the daunting task of dealing with insurance companies and the federal government. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
As soon as the floodwaters receded in East Houston, the Hernandez family got to work.
We're just right here trying to clean out the backyard and get any trash and get the water flowing out of the yard so we can at least be dry back here, and then we'll worry about the inside, I suppose.
Inside Jerry Ann Hernandez's home, there's evidence of the scramble to get things above the rising water. One prized possession that made it with little damage, her daughter's quinceañera dress, all bright pink tulle and gold sequins.
She waited forever for that quinceañera, and this is just something that she loves, and I know that it means a lot to her, so I had to get it out here to dry so it wouldn't get moldy on her.
The waters reached a couple of feet inside, which means most of their furniture is still saturated with stinking floodwater. The carpet will have to go. The drywall is waterlogged. Hernandez applied for FEMA assistance right away, but now she feels stuck.
We really, right now, don't know what to do as far as our belongings and as far as cleaning up our home. We don't know if we should leave our stuff here the way it is and let them see it, or if we should try to just clean it out and, you know, help the process along run a little bit more smoother, I guess, and get as far as advanced in our steps as we can.
To answer that question, what to do next, I called Carmen Rodriguez. She's a spokeswoman for the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Well, if the family is able to start cleaning the house, they can do it. But what we suggest is for them to take photos of all the damage. Take photos before you start cleaning.
FEMA oversees the National Flood Insurance Program, and Rodriguez says in some cases, inspectors won't even need to come in person to process a claim, like if they know a whole neighborhood was flooded.
Sometimes the person registered for assistance, and we already know when they tell us the address where the house is located that the house was completely flooded.
Here's the thing, though. 4 out of 5 people in Harris County don't have flood insurance. Jerry Ann Hernandez had flood insurance for years, but canceled it because she'd never needed it. And it's also really expensive. Her neighbor, Christy Garcia, skipped it altogether when she moved in a few doors down a decade ago.
When we purchased our house, they didn't ask for it. They told us we weren't in a flood zone, so we didn't get it.
Most home insurance doesn't cover flood damage, and with more than 150 homes damaged, Bob Hunter says a lot of folks will be left in the lurch. He's from the Consumer Federation of America, and he says FEMA does offer some options.
You may be able to get some grant money to get back into the house, a few thousand dollars at most. That sometimes will be available without strings. It all depends how Congress sets this up.
Beyond that, he says FEMA aid for homeowners comes mostly in the form of low-interest loans, not grants, which means they have to get paid back.
For people who have a good job and money in the bank, that's feasible. For some people with low incomes, it may not be feasible to put another loan on top of what they're already paying through their regular mortgage. And in fact, if you look at the Ninth Ward of New Orleans and walk around there now, quite a few people walked away from their homes and they're now just lots.
Bottom line, Hunter says, apply for help from FEMA and file those insurance claims as quickly as possible and keep detailed notes of every interaction. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Houston.
The United Nations Security Council met in emergency session today following North Korea's latest and largest ever nuclear test on Sunday. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley urged the Security Council to take the strongest possible measures against North Korea.
The stakes could not be higher. The urgency is now. 24 years of half measures and failed talks is enough.
Well, let's get some analysis of where we find ourselves. Abe Denmark, he's director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I mean, what is your overall reaction to North Korea's nuclear test just yesterday?
It's a very unfortunate culmination of several years of progress by North Korea, which accelerated greatly after Kim Jong-un took power after the death of his father, in which he greatly accelerated the pace of missile tests and as well as nuclear tests, all, it seems, toward developing a credible nuclear capability that has the ability to strike not only South Korea and Japan, but also the United States.
Right. I mean, so it seems as if we've been sort of inevitably headed towards this point for some time. But given the scale of the test, as far as we can tell, does that in and of itself mark some kind of turning point?
It certainly seems to. The previous five tests have been growing in size, and it seems that this test seemed to overcome a certain kind of hurdle that it suggests that North Korea's nuclear scientists have figured out how to develop what it claims to be a thermonuclear device, which is a very large device. It's something that's going to be would be several orders of magnitude larger than what exploded at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the 1940s. And given their missile capabilities, would give North Korea the capability to inflict incredible damage against the continental United States as well as countries across the Asia Pacific.
Hmm. Now, I'm seeing here reports from the Associated Press that U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley says the United States will circulate a draft resolution later this week pushing for further sanctions against North Korea. But as we just played in that tape earlier today, she said that, 24 years of other measures have failed. So how effective would any new sanctions regime be on North Korea now?
She gave Ambassador Haley gave a very strong statement in New York today, saying that American patience is not infinite, also saying that the piecemeal efforts of past UN Security Council resolutions has not been effective. So her argument was that there needed to be sort of a maximalist effort to maximize pressure on North Korea by cutting off their economic ties to the rest of the world. And the claim is that the theory behind that strategy is that by cutting off North Korea from any economic activity that also touches on the United States and the legitimate international market, that it would force Kim Jong-un to come to his senses and to begin negotiations toward denuclearization. And we have not seen that yet. What Nikki Haley would call the piecemeal efforts have not been successful at bringing him to the table. But it does remain to be seen if maximum pressure, as the Trump administration calls it, has those results. But there's a lot of skepticism.
So there's the limited effectiveness of economic pressure, as you just talked about. But the Trump administration is also using and has also used quite strong terms regarding possible military pressure. I mean, just yesterday, Defense Secretary James Mattis said the U.S. isn't considering the total annihilation of North Korea, not considering that, but that the U.S. response would be overwhelming and swift if necessary. I mean, is there a military option here or a greater role for the military in containing North Korea?
There certainly is a role for the U.S. military and the militaries of our allies in this, both to contain and deter, but also to increase pressure on Kim Jong-un. The statement that you referred to by Secretary Mattis was actually quite similar to statements that were used in the last few years of the Obama administration. So there's actually a great deal of continuity there. But clearly, there needs to be a greater emphasis on deterrence, that as North Korea develops these nuclear weapons, develops these missiles, that both deterring attack, deterring provocations, but also reassuring our allies of the credibility of American deterrence and the credibility of our will to come to their defense in the possibility of a North Korean attack is going to be absolutely critical going forward.
Well, we've just got about 20 seconds here. I mean, if you had the president's ear now, what would you be advising him?
I would be emphasizing the importance of synchronizing our messaging to ensure that all aspects of the U.S. government is singing the same song, but also of developing, enhancing our military posture in the region to ensure that we have the ability both to respond to provocations, but also to reassure our allies of our commitment.
Well, Abe Denmark is the director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center. He was also Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia. Thank you so much for your perspective today.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's turn to a different crisis in Asia. Refugees from Myanmar are fleeing into neighboring Bangladesh by the tens of thousands. They are Rohingyas, Muslims who say they're trying to escape the latest escalation of violence against them. They're now overwhelming camps in Bangladesh. The BBC's Akbar Hussain is with us via Skype from Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. And Akbar, what can you tell us about the scene at the border with Myanmar today? What's happening?
Situation is very grim there because many people are living under open sky. They don't have any food. They don't have any access to pure drinking water. They don't have any medical facilities. A lot of thousands of women and children are languishing their lives in makeshift camps. And many aid agencies, they are describing the situation as catastrophic.
Mm. Well, it's clearly a terrible situation, Akbar. Remind us, though, for folks who are not familiar, who are the Rohingya?
Yes, who are Rohingyas? This is a million-dollar question. Myanmar government always says these Rohingya Muslims, they are from Bangladesh, they are Bengalis. But these Rohingya Muslims, they claim they have been living in the Myanmar's Rakhine state for centuries, for generations. And 1 million up to 1.3 million Rohingya communities are living there. It is their habitat for centuries. But for last 30 years, Rohingya communities are very persecuted in Myanmar. They don't have any rights in Myanmar. They don't have a minimum citizens or human rights in Myanmar. They are called stateless people. That's why many of them left Myanmar and took shelter in Bangladesh. And according to Bangladesh government estimate, they think more than 500,000 Rohingyas took shelter in Bangladesh in last 20 years. So Myanmar government says that they are Bengalis, they don't have any right in Myanmar. And on the other hand, Bangladesh says that no, they are not Bangladeshis, no question at all. They have been living there for centuries. It is their responsibility. It is Myanmar's responsibility to look after their citizen. So it is the Rohingyas are their citizen. But still, if you talk about Rohingyas with Myanmar government, Bangladesh government, you will get both versions. But Rohingya themselves say they belong to Burma. They have been living in Rakhine state for centuries.
So you mentioned that they have been long repressed in Myanmar, but we're seeing reports that they are being massacred by security forces there. So what exactly is happening and why is it happening now?
This time only 2 weeks ago, several police camps came under attack And Myanmar military described that those police camps were attacked by alleged Islamic militants who belong to Rohingya community. They are doing separatist movement inside Myanmar. So after those attacks, Myanmar military, they went out for all-out anti-terror operation in Rakhine State and counter-insurgency operation in Rakhine State. Many Muslims were killed. According to their allegation, people who fled to Bangladesh, they say Myanmar military, they either burnt many Rohingya Muslims to death or hacked them to death, and many of them fled their home and they tried to take shelter inside Bangladesh.
And finally, Akbar, what has Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, I mean, who famously won the Nobel Peace Prize after being under house arrest in Myanmar for years, what has she said about what's happening there?
The role of Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate, is heavily being criticized by different quarters. Even only today, the UN special rapporteur to Myanmar, Yanki Lee, who visited Bangladesh to see the Rohingya crisis 6 months ago, she also mentioned that it is time for Ms. Suu Kyi to step in Rohingya problem. And other people, even Bangladesh government, some senior ministers of the Bangladesh and other, even Malaysia and Indonesia, they are also criticizing Aung San Suu Kyi for not responding enough to the crisis. But on different occasion, Aung San Suu Kyi denied that these Rohingya Muslims are being persecuted in Rakhine State. She said that attention is going on, that is true, but the Buddhists in Myanmar and Muslims in Myanmar, both sides are living in fear. She is supporting the action of Myanmar's military. That is very strange. And many people are saying that being a Nobel laureate, how could Aung San Suu Kyi could defend the action of military in Rakhine State? So the situation is so grave that even Aung San Suu Kyi, she doesn't like to admit the crisis. She rather, on different occasions, putting the blame on Rohingya community to create instability in that region.
Hmm. Well, Akbar Hussain is with the BBC's Bengali service, speaking to us from Dhaka in Bangladesh. Akbar, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump is expected to make an announcement tomorrow about the future of the Obama-era immigration program known as DACA. That's short for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which protects some young people living in the country illegally from deportation. Last week, hundreds of entrepreneurs and business leaders signed an open letter asking the president to preserve the program. They said ending DACA could cost the economy more than $460 billion. Let's get more from Ali Velshi. He's an MSNBC anchor and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi there, Ali.
Hi, Magna.
So this $460 billion, where'd the figure come from and how much of a hit would it be to the economy?
It's hard to get a complete handle on this. And part of that is because DACA didn't exist until 2012. And in the time since then, about 800,000 people have been added to the program. About 95% of them currently in school. And then a big proportion of those who are not in school are working. So it's just it is very, very hard to get a handle on what the contribution is to the economy. Here's what they can and can't do. They get a temporary stay against deportation. They can get driver's licenses. They can get work. Obviously, they have a work permit. They can't receive any federal benefits like Social Security, college financial aid, food stamps, things like that. And they are required to pay federal income taxes. So generally speaking, they are a net positive to the economy because they contribute to the economy based on the money they earn, and they pay federal income taxes, which makes them different from a number of other undocumented immigrants who don't pay those taxes.
So is that where that $460 billion figure is coming? Or you said earlier we can't really quantify it.
Right. It's just hard to quantify. I've seen that number. I've seen other numbers. And these are all extrapolations, right? Remember, 45% of these people are still in school. So they might be working a job out of school. They're going to graduate. The better way to look at this is what they end up being, mm-hmm. right? Because they are all English speakers, they've all been either gotten an education or are working as a result of it. The degree to which they work, the proportion is higher than the general population. And they now can make money that they couldn't make before. You need to sort of think about it in terms of their potential earning as opposed to their current earning. But I I think it's fair to say that they are a contributor, net contributor to the economy, not detractors.
Right. So yesterday we heard from Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. He talked about the possibility of ending DACA. He was on Fox News.
As it relates to the economic impact, I'm less concerned about the economic impact. We'll make sure that we have plenty of workers in this economy. We want to put more people back to work. There's a lot of people that left the workforce, and our objective is to bring them back into the workforce.
So, Ollie, he's saying there that, you know, these DACA program folks might have to leave, but we have workers that could replace them.
Yeah, he's sort of wrong about that. We have a very, very low unemployment rate, but we've got a lot of people who are stubbornly without jobs. That is a mismatch between the skill set that our unemployed workers have in this country and the geographies in which they live, particularly in places that were concentrated in manufacturing or mining, and the shortages, which tend to be in more knowledge economy areas and technology. The issue we have is what we'd love to be able to do is take unemployed mine workers from Kentucky and West Virginia, retrain them and make them coders. Mm-hmm. That's a bigger conversation, and it's a different conversation. But in fact, the people who are the dreamers don't tend to be concentrated in the places where we've got those worker shortages. So, no, two different stories.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He co-hosts Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Mago.
Last week, Amazon finalized its $13.7 billion acquisition of Whole Foods Market, an acquisition that sent shocks through the grocery industry. Federal regulators gave the merger a swift approval, saying it would not hurt competition. But the move has renewed calls among some researchers and activists for antitrust action against Amazon and other tech conglomerates like Facebook and Google, which the critics say have monopolies over their respective markets. And one of those critics is Matt Stoller. He's a fellow at the think tank Open Markets, and he joins me now. Matt, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks.
So first of all, let me just get your take on this. Is Amazon a monopoly?
Certainly in some areas, yes.
And what areas would you say it's most monopolistic?
Well, I mean, the oldest area it's been in is books, and it certainly has control of at least the ebook market, probably the whole book market.
And so then, you know, there's a regulatory definition of monopolies. I mean, how would we define what a monopoly is?
The definition I like is what Louis Brandeis gave to Congress in 1913, which is that it's unified control of a recognized branch of trade in a good or service.
Okay, so given that, I mean, I suppose a lot of people can think about the early 20th centuries and the monopolies that existed there in various industries. And then there's also, you know, in telephone monopolies that we had at one time or another. But today, in the economy today, I mean, what companies do you see are the best examples of a new golden age of monopolies?
Well, I mean, there are certain monopolies that are what one would call natural, which is to say, like electric utilities, where it just doesn't make sense to string multiple power lines into buildings. And those need to be regulated. But in terms of markets where you could have rivals, but you don't have rivals, you know, you can just see something like search engines. There's basically Google. And what Google does essentially structures the internet. For social media, you have Facebook. And for online retail, while there are alternatives, Amazon is capturing an increasing amount of online commerce. Mm. So I would say those three institutions are the most obvious and most powerful monopolistic institutions in our culture right now.
So it's interesting because, of course, one immediate counterargument to the use of the word monopoly is that companies might say, well, our size allows us to achieve a certain economy of scale. And that's a familiar argument, right? Anytime a couple of big companies want to merge, they immediately say it's good for consumers because we can achieve scale.
Sure.
What's your thought about that?
Well, I mean, there's the difference between monopoly and just a traditional kind of economy of scale is that monopoly is a financial arrangement. So if you own a bunch of factories, each factory might be a certain size because it's, say that they're producing goods independently of one another. You know, they might be a certain size because they need to be that size to be most efficient. But the ownership of those factories in common, that's a financial arrangement that doesn't have anything to do with economies of scale. But there are also diseconomies of scale. So as an example, you have something like fake news, right? Fake news, which moves through the platforms of Facebook and Google, which are actually financed by the advertising monopoly of Facebook and Google. That's something that Facebook and Google don't like, but it operates on their platform. And it's just because those institutions are too big to actually take care of the of actually the property that they're supposed to manage.
So you got to a point I was going to make, or a question I was going to ask you, which is, what would you see as the downsides or the harm that these modern day would be monopolies maybe doing by virtue of their size and reach?
Right. Well, there's a lot of downsides, but the most the way it was traditionally formulated in American history is this concept of absentee ownership, which is to say that the people that own a property don't live near it and don't take care of it because it doesn't affect them. Traditionally, we've had a goal in this country of keeping institutions small and local, retail, banks, farms. We've always wanted them to be family-owned or as small as possible. And certain institutions like auto companies or chemical companies need a certain amount of scale. And then you have network monopolies like, you know, telephones and electric utilities. But what happens when you do organize, say, chain stores like Walmart or now Amazon, is you have communities that lose their control over the institutions that organize their retail space. So you've seen you lose community leadership, you lose, you know, local charity, you lose local bank deposits. So you've seen in areas that are dominated by Walmart, you know, you see a spike in obesity, you see a drop in voting rates, you see a whole bunch of social indicators that are negative. And you'll probably see that as well with Amazon, although there hasn't been the sociological research done yet.
Isn't part of the problem here that these companies are monopolies in the eyes of some by virtue of the fact that they also created the markets or the industries that they're in? I mean, like, so before Facebook became as big as it did, we didn't really have a robust social media market, right? And same with online retail. Like, so it's like almost putting the cart before the horse here. And is that a challenge for regulators now?
Well, I would just take issue with the premise of the question. So we did have social networking before Facebook. We had MySpace. We had actually a competitive market. And we've seen the development of new social networks since Facebook emerged. Like, for example, you saw the development of Instagram, WhatsApp. You know, Google, same thing. They created a search engine, but you also you saw them buy DoubleClick. You saw them buy YouTube. You saw them buy AdMob. So these are institutions that are not actually creating industries, although that happens in some cases. These are conglomerates. They are the product of acquisitions which are inherently political. So they like to pretend like they invented all of this cool stuff. In fact, they did invent a little bit of it, but most of it is just about capturing what other people did.
So do you think that there should be some regulation or some antitrust regulation specifically brought to these companies?
Yeah, I mean, these are, you know, you need a mix of antitrust investigations just to figure out how these companies organize these industries, how they use data, how they manipulate us, what kind of prices they charge. Are there discriminatory prices? What are they doing in terms of racial, ethnic, gender-based choices? And then what you'd basically do is you'd use a mix of antitrust to block them from using power in one market to get into another market. You might need to, say, separate the search engine from the advertising network or from YouTube. And then at the same time, you'd have to lay what are called public utility rules or common carriage rules on, say, Google, like the Europeans just did, saying that they couldn't favor their own services through their own search engine.
Right.
So it would be a mix of rules.
I just want to jump in here because you bring up the European counterexample, which is an excellent one. Like, Europe does effectively see Google as a monopoly and has slapped them with a huge fine, right?
Yeah. And in fact, the FTC, our FTC did as well. They saw them as engaging in anti-competitive behavior. They just hid the study and didn't do anything about it. But the Europeans said, you know, Google, what you did is you created your own search cost comparison site. You downgraded everyone else's, and then you got rid of, once you drove everyone else out of business, then you got rid of your own cost comparison site and made it all advertising based. And so now there are no cost comparison sites because of your monopolistic, the abuse of the, essentially the railroad tracks that you own, which are the, you know, the search engine. And they said, we're going to fine you $2.7 billion, and we're going to implement a rule saying you have to give equal treatment to everyone who is on the internet. You can't prioritize your own services.
Mm. But do you think that there's any appetite in Washington whatsoever to really more pointedly address the monopolistic tendencies of, you know, these giant companies, Google, Amazon, that are so interwoven into American life because, what, the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it both declined to bring a single major monopolization suit against an American company. So I don't see anything turning that tide.
Well, I'm optimistic. There's been an intellectual kind of breakdown in American anti-monopoly rules since essentially the early 80s. But because what we saw with the financial crisis, the creation of too big to fail institutions, there's now an appetite among the public. And now economists and lawyers are doing research that actually looks at these institutions and says, you know what, we really do need to bring back some of these monopoly rules. And I see appetite on both the Republican and the Democratic side on this.
Matt Stoller is a fellow at the Open Markets Program. Really fascinating conversation, Matt. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Now, we should note that we spoke with Stoller a bit earlier, and since we taped that conversation, Stoller's think tank, Open Markets, was forced to spin off from its parent organization, the left-leaning New America Foundation, because of pressure from Google, a major funder. Last week, New America fired the director of the Open Markets Program, a longtime critic of Google. Both Google and New America have denied accusations that the move was retribution for criticism of the company's business practices. You're listening to Here and Now. Kids across the country will be heading off to school this week, if they aren't already back in the classroom, that is. For some, that first day is full of excitement. For many others, it can evoke terrible anxiety. Erica Lance from WBUR brings us a story of a boy who dreaded returning to school and a biker who helped change that.
Oh, to describe it. Have you ever jumped out of a plane?
Brett Moorfield doesn't jump out of planes, but he does love the open road.
It's just free. The closest you can get to flying.
Moorfield works at a motorcycle shop in Auburn, a town in northeast Indiana, and he rides his bike every day.
You got the wind in your face, the sun beating down on you. Look behind you in your mirror and see hundreds of bikes just rolling over a little hill. I forget my worries. Just look out and it's wind therapy.
When he's not riding, Warfield spends a lot of time helping others. Every Christmas, he collects money and buys presents for families who can't afford them. That's how he met Tammy Mick. Mick has three kids, and as she talked to Warfield at the motorcycle shop about Christmas, she told him about one of them in particular, her youngest, Phil, who was 10 at the time. One day, she said, when Phil came home from school, she noticed he was holding his hand to his head.
He was hiding his forehead, and I went to move his hand to see what was wrong, and I found it.
A goose egg on my head.
I was fire engine mad. I asked him what happened, and he finally broke down and told me.
Phil told his mom that a boy at school slammed his head into a wall, and it wasn't the first time he'd gotten picked on. His mother didn't know it, but kids had been bullying Phil for years. They'd kick him, hit him, make fun of his clothes, and taunt him for being overweight.
It felt like I was underground and getting caved in.
Phil had lots of dreams, dark dreams that brought his mom running to his bed to see what was wrong. In his dreams, bullies beat him. Then one night, he dreamt something even worse.
I had one dream about that I actually killed myself. It came to a point where I just didn't want to live anymore.
When his mom heard about that dream, she says it was like someone had driven a knife through her. So when she met Warfield, she told him how helpless she felt, and he could relate.
I grew up poor. Other traumatic events in my life as a child that just very painful childhood.
Mick told him that Phil was starting middle school this fall, and Warfield decided the boy needed a fresh start. So he made a plan. First, he took Phil shopping for school supplies and clothes and took him to dinner.
He goes, "Me and Brent did this and that, Mom," and he just was all smiles.
But that was just part one of Warfield's plan. He posted a call out on Facebook to the motorcycle community. At 6 a.m. a few days later, Brent and 50 other bikers met Phil and his family at a local restaurant. They came to escort Phil to the first day of school.
Big long row of motorcycles. The sun was coming out. People on Facebook that knew what we were doing that day were driving by and honking their horn and waving.
Phil was nervous about getting on the bike. He's like, "Mom, I don't think I can do this." I said, yes, you can. I said, you can do this.
Phil got on the back of one of the motorcycles, and all 50 of them started riding, with Phil at the front of the pack.
He's just totally full of confidence and glowing.
When I was on the bike, I felt like I was God's son, full of joy and all that. It felt like a million bucks.
They dropped him off at the front door, with the principal there to greet him. Phil's been in middle school a few weeks now. His mom says he loves it, and Warfield checks in every other day to see how they're all doing.
I hope he's in our life forever because he's family.
Phil's dreaming again. A different dream, though. The first time, it started scary.
I was having a nightmare.
But the nightmare changed, and a unicorn appeared. Then Phil was on the unicorn's back, flying. He said riding the unicorn was like riding with Warfield and the bikers.
It felt like the same thing, and the unicorns talked. It was like God gave the unicorn powers to talk to me and make me feel like I belong in this world.
The unicorn told Phil not to give up, because everything would be okay.
And it actually came true.
Decades after his own traumatic childhood, Warfield gives other kids what he never had, deep support and a community of mentors.
If you see a kid getting picked on or bullied, step in. Everybody can help in one way or another.
Motorcycles drive the road near Phil's house all the time. And every time Phil hears the sound of those engines, he smiles, he says, and knows he's not alone. His bikers have his back. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
And Erica's story comes to us from Kind World, a podcast produced by WBUR Boston. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin and Jeremy return to grace your airwaves tomorrow. This is Here and Now.